Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. If you've ever been at a loss to help someone in times of struggle, it could be because you haven't been trained properly. Dr. Gerard Jacobs is the author of the upcoming book, Community-Based Psychological First Aid. It's a practical guide to helping individuals and communities during difficult times. It's designed to help everyday people care for one another. Dr. Jacobs was summoned to Nepal after last year's massive earthquake. He has trained groups and individuals in more than 30 countries. He's a professor of psychology and director of the Disaster Mental Health Institute at USD. Dr. Jacobs, welcome to Dakota Midday.
Thank you, Lori.
Welcome back, I should say. Let's go ahead and start talking about this book. It's based on the theory that everyday people can help one another. Tell me something about the book and why you decided to approach it.
Well, this is pretty much the work that I've been doing for most of my career, trying to help individuals to know how to support their family, their friends, their neighbors during difficult times in life, whether it's a disaster or just a rough day.
We were talking before we came on air about how your job has sort of been, it's evolved over the past 20 years at least, and before. Talk a little bit about what existed before you started in this field and how quickly it has changed.
Well, there was very little that was called disaster mental health. There were a few people that were trying to do some support, but no systematic approach. And Dr. Randy Quivlin, the chair of our department, and myself proposed the development of a national plan for disaster mental health back in 1991. And now that's pretty much taken for granted. We do have a national plan, and we're able to work with basically any disaster that occurs in the nation. There's professionals that can be there to support. But after September 11th, we learned that it was very important to have something more than mental health professionals, that we needed to teach the general population how to care for one another. Mm-hmm. Because in really large events, or in the smaller events that occur in areas that don't have a lot of mental health professionals, there needs to be basic psychological support provided, as they do it in much of Europe.
And people want to care for each other in general. Certainly in South Dakota, they do. Are there cultural differences? Does pretty much universally people want to help each other? Is that what you're seeing?
The amazing thing to me, I expected that there would be great differences in how different parts of the world would accept these ideas. But in fact, there's just been a pretty universal acceptance of this as just making good common sense. If you want to support your family, your friends, when they're going through a rough time, this is the strategy that seems to make sense to every religion, every culture that we've encountered.
Give me some ideas. Let's start from the beginning. One of the first thoughts I had was, can you do harm if someone has experienced a trauma? You're in the midst of a disaster, or they've experienced a personal trauma, and you want to help. Can that backfire?
Well, it's important to understand when someone does need a mental health professional to be involved. Mm-hmm. And one of the chapters in the book, indeed, is to recognize when it might be possible to do harm and when you need to get someone professional assistance. There's lots of things, though, that people go through that don't require the help of a mental health professional. You know, if we have a really rough day, even if it's a terrible day, if we have a loved one die, that may be a very difficult time for us, but it doesn't mean we have to go to a mental health professional. We can learn how to support one another and know when we need to get a mental health professional involved.
So give me some of the specifics of the strategy. How do I help?
Well, probably the core skill is being a good active listener. And good listening skills are probably the most important thing we can do to try to provide support to one another. And so we spend a good part of the beginning of the book talking about how to be a really good listener. And good listening skills are not just about psychological support. Research shows that people with good listening skills are also more likely to get hired, they're more likely to get promoted, they're more likely to have romantic lovers. And so good listening skills can help every aspect of your life.
What makes a good listener? What are some of the hallmarks of being a good listener?
Being really focused on the person that's speaking to you and trying to make sure you're understanding what they're saying to you. And there are specific skills developed by a psychologist named Carl Rogers around the 1950s. And we talk about those skills and how to live out those skills in daily life. And it's something that mental health professionals take literally years to learn. But the fact is, the basics of good active listening can be learned pretty simply.
It can be learned. Do some people come at it from a more natural standpoint, or some people just naturally better listeners than others? And is that gender-based? Is that
I don't think there is a gender-based difference, and I'm not sure whether it's something that you're born with or if it's just the caring people tend to spend more time focusing on the person that they're listening to. Mm. But certainly there's people who seem to be more natural listeners than others. But the fact is anybody can learn to be a good listener.
So what's next? Learning to be a good active listener is one of the first steps. We talked about recognizing when somebody needs true mental health professional intervention. What are some of the other steps?
Well, another step that's important is knowing what to do after you've heard them tell their story.
Right.
and part of what you have to understand is what may be useful to the person in terms of moving forward. And so we also talk about problem-solving techniques in the book and how to go about finding a solution that works for the person you're trying to support. Many people go into that kind of a situation thinking, okay, I've got just the answer for them. But it's important that we find a solution that works for the person we're trying to support. And so the book tries to give some guidance on how to do that.
How do you break something like that down? Because people are so different. So how do you break down something like that? It seems like that, you know, you said it might take decades for a mental health professional to really learn those skills. How do you cover it in a book that will give you enough information to be useful?
Well, luckily, we don't need the entire population to be mental health professionals.
Right.
and so we can teach some of the basic skills that can help people to work through most situations that they're going to experience, and again, to know when to bring in a mental health professional to go beyond.
All right. So helping figure out what that person might need next.
Right.
And you do that through listening. They're connected.
Well, they're very tightly connected, yes. The listening sets up the problem solving.
Okay.
If you haven't done a good listening job, you're probably not going to do a good problem solving job.
Okay. Keep going. Are we walking through a set of steps here? Or?
Well, we also talk about the importance of instrumental assistance, and that's just a big fancy word for providing practical help for people.
Mm.
If you've been through something like a disaster, or if you've been through something terrible like a car accident, sometimes people just need basic kinds of help. One of the things that amazed a lot of mental health professionals that responded to the crash of Flight 232 in 1989 in Sioux City was that the primary thing that needed to be done was to listen to people tell their story and to get them food, water, mm-hmm. A pillow to sleep on. And those practical things were just as important as the listening and anything else we might bring to the table as professionals. Many mental health professionals, when they get involved in disaster, expect to go out and ride in on their white horse and do magic things. But in fact, most of what we do is try to provide just realistic, practical support to people as we listen to their story.
Hmm. What's the role of having been through something yourself? I'm thinking about, you know, when my father died, you could tell people were trying to help. And then I had one friend named Lisa who showed up at my back door with a pot of chili, and it was designed for the food sensitivities in our household, and her father had died 3 years ago. And so she knew exactly what needed to be done because she had been through it. So talk a little bit about how experience helps you, pay it forward, kind of.
Well, experience can be beneficial. Right now, my wife is battling cancer, and some of the most meaningful support we've received is from people who are survivors themselves or have survivors in their families because they understand the difficulties that are involved in trying to become a survivor. And at the same time, sometimes people who have been through it before didn't handle it very well, and they have very unprofitable ideas about how to proceed. And so being experienced doesn't magically bring you the right solution,
right.
but sometimes it can.
Interesting. How do you care for yourself while you're caring for other people? When you talk about giving care to someone who's going through a major health crisis, that wears you down after a while. You've been through many natural disasters, and you've seen people suffer. How do you take care of yourself in the view of all that suffering?
I follow the same procedures that I talk about in the book. I practice what I preach. All of those things are things that I do as well. I make sure I've got somebody that is a good listener to talk to. When I first started in this work, I tried to find somebody outside my family. And my wife sat me down and said, let me explain to you that this is not going to work. You know, if you can't bring me in as a good listener, then you're going to have to learn to do it. Mm. And indeed, she was right. It worked much better for our relationship when we did it as husband and wife, as opposed to going outside to talk about the stress of the job.
That's interesting. So bringing it home actually worked for you because of how you did it. Whereas in other relationships, that might cause a barrier to have to bring that job stress home and expect your spouse to provide.
Well, it might, support. But at the same time, again, if you follow the practical suggestions in the book, you learn how to do that, how to support one another, you know, when it's time for doing somebody else in to do the listing and when maybe it is time to take it outside of your relationship.
Are there parallels between, you know, a car accident, I think you mentioned, an assault, like a personal physical assault against you, and a major disaster like an earthquake or a hurricane?
There are similarities in terms of people's experience of the stress of those events, but there are also real differences. A deliberate act such as an assault, physical assault, sexual assault, is compared by one of my colleagues to a terrorist attack because the intentional act is much more stressful for people. But the basic stress that people experience is pretty similar, and in fact, the ways to support people are pretty similar.
Do some communities have more resilience? And if so, what sort of commonalities do you see about a community that really sort of survives a tornado or a community disaster or a terrorist attack? I won't say survives it well. I don't know what the right terminology would be.
Sure. Indeed, many communities, I mean, we can see real differences in communities in terms of their resilience. You know, I think of living in rural frontier areas, you know, some small towns you instantly know are friendly towns. Mm-hmm. Other towns, maybe not so much. The towns that are friendly rely on one another, they build that sense of community, and they're able to handle much more difficult times. But that can also be true within neighborhoods in cities. And I could go into that in more detail, but one of my favorite stories, but I'll hold back.
Give me an idea how this book is going to be used. How do you hope that it will be used? Do you hope that it's ordered by individuals who are just going to read it in a community setting, academic setting?
I hope actually across the spectrum, because the publisher, Elsevier, is a famous science publisher, and they're trying to target it towards first responders and mental health professionals. And I think that's good. We've done a lot of work with first responders and mental health professionals. But I think it's also important for the general public. The Institute of Medicine, part of the National Academies of Science, and the National Preparedness and Response Science Board have recommended community-based psychological first aid for the general population. Hmm. And so these are the two major reports that have come out from the federal government, and I think it's important for the general public to learn these skills as well to face whatever is in our future, basically.
Can you give me an example of something working well? Of a sort of a community event where the citizens, the people who were involved, were able to give each other a kind of support. Can you give me any examples?
You're leading into my favorite story. in New York, after the crash of Flight 592, 2 months after the terrorist attacks, the community was devastated in one neighborhood. Most of the firefighters who died in the towers lived there, and then a plane crashed in the middle of their neighborhood. Mm-hmm. They were already having daily funerals for firefighters being recovered from the towers. And then this plane crashed in the middle, and we wanted to bring, as is typically done in a plane crash, we wanted to bring the families of those who died to see the site. And they did not want that. And I said, they're going to come one way or the other. If we do it in an organized way, it'll happen once. Otherwise, it'll stretch out for months. When we arrived, bringing the families in, it was a very cold night, and the entire community had turned out. They'd put up folding tables, and they served the families hot coffee, hot chocolate, tea. They had cakes baked, and they welcomed the people. They hugged them. They understood their grief. That kind of outpouring of love and support for one another, unknown people, you know, but neighbors nevertheless, was a powerful example to me in all the work I've done of somebody really putting aside their own difficulties and reaching out to those who need support.
And I knew about halfway through that you were going to make me cry. You've been listening to Dr. Gerard Jacobs. The book is called Community-Based Psychological First Aid, A Practical Guide to Helping Individuals and Communities During Difficult Times. It's available for pre-order now. Thank you so much for joining us. You'll come back, won't you?
Sure, Laura. Thank you.